When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Artem Chapai, author of The Ukraine, translated from Ukrainian by Zhenya Tomkins and published by Seven Stories Press in 2024. Artem Chapai is a Ukrainian writer, reporter, and translator. In 2014, Artem Chapai worked as a reporter covering the war in the Donbas. In collaboration with Katerina Zaradzkova, he co-authored and published The Three-Letter War, a collection of their reporting on the initial stage of the Russo-Ukrainian War. Artem's work has been translated into many languages and appeared in the best European fiction anthology. Artem Chapai himself is also a translator. Among the works that he translated is Humanism and Democratic Criticism by Edward Said. After the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine began in 2022, Artem Chapai volunteered for the army and enlisted in the armed forces of Ukraine. Hello, Artem, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, Natalia. Thank you for the invitation.
So, should we start with the title? Because the title to many will sound, of course, provocative, if not scandalous. And as you know, it's been our struggle to change the name of the country from the Ukraine to Ukraine. And the final story of this collection provides some explanation why it's the Ukraine. But before the readers get to that point, I think they would be wondering why it's the Ukraine.
Yes, in fact, the title was supposed to be provocative and maybe even triggering to some people.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I was writing the book, of course, I did not think it would be translated into any other language. At the time, unfortunately, Ukrainian literature was not so, popular, or rather, people were not just interested in Ukraine as such. Mm-hmm. So the title was supposed to be provocative, first of all, to Ukrainian readers. It was written, was a reaction to all this trying to show Ukraine as a very beautiful, abstract land. And at the time, I remember, there were a lot of filming with the drones from very far. And so my intention was to show Ukraine from the inside, to show not only the beautiful side of the country, which of course is very beautiful, but also stuff like poverty, or for example, at the moment my elevator hasn't been working for more than a month. All this decay, all this, everything that we actually have to face on a daily basis. And by using the title "The Ukraine," I was kind of provoking and arguing with the people who only want, including foreigners, to see only the nice parts of the country. I wanted to show the country for Ukrainians who know what it is like. And with the title, yes, it was a provocation towards the beautiful presenters. And on the other side, I knew what I was doing, because I was actually quoting a quote from D.H. Lawrence, wrote about similar persons in England, and he said that they have forgotten the England which is really England. So here, the Ukraine is like the Ukraine which is really Ukraine. That's one thing. And the other thing, of course, the book refers to the incorrect usage of the article. And the last story says how irritating it is when foreigners say something like this. And so this is trying to use this for ourselves. It's something similar as the black people start to use the N-word for themselves, trying to repossess it.
So you started writing these stories back in 2010, right? So it took a couple of years. And of course, then some new stories appeared after 2014. But one of the characters in this collection at the end of the story says to the narrator that, well, you traveled across Ukraine. What did you see? So I assume that you traveled across Ukraine and of course, you just enumerated what things you would like to show. But since the introduction part in English mentions that with this collection, you also want to explain to people why Ukrainians are fighting for their land and why Ukrainians love their land, I'm wondering how this perception for you changed from what you saw, for instance, in 2010, what you saw in 2014, and what you are seeing right now.
In 2010, I was just traveling all over the country on a motorcycle, sometimes hitchhiking, sometimes walking, and I have been doing it ever since, until the invasion started. Now I cannot travel freely. And at the moment, of course, I didn't think it would become a collection of stories or a book or something. I was just doing reporting. Sometimes I felt that it's better to show something as a short story, as a fiction story. Sometimes it's better. And the idea to collect it only came to me in 2018. It was very different stories from different parts of the country. But yes, I like traveling the country and traveling the, like, not touristic parts of the country. Not, if we're talking to American readers, not like the national parks, but rather the backlands. That's what interesting. My perception changed a lot, and unfortunately, after 2022, it has changed a little bit to the worse. If we're talking about the people, because it's the last story finishes with I don't know how it was translated, but in Ukrainian it was that people are wonderful even though they don't understand it, or even when they don't understand it. And now I would say that some people are wonderful. And these are those people who chose to oppose the Russian invasion, who chose not to forfeit and not to run away, if we're talking about males at least. So here, I would say I have different opinions about different people now. Mm-hmm. But yes, for me, it is very important to show how and why Ukrainians decided to defend all these imperfections. And right now, it is my opinion that it is this not politically correct and not beautiful, the Ukraine, which is actually defending Ukraine, as shown by the, like, nationalists or promoters or presenters, because I have been with the very simple, sometimes very poor people who have chosen to defend Ukraine. And since I was a volunteer, it so happened that I was also surrounded mostly by volunteers, because the units that were collected at the time, that were brought together at the time, mostly were comprised of volunteers. Like, for example, in my platoon, which is like about 100, yeah, the platoon in English, I think about a half were the people who actually were volunteers, and about a half of those were actually people who came back from the abroad. Because Ukrainians, as a poor country, something similar to the Poles, many people work abroad. But many of these people came back in order to defend their land, even though, like, my best friend, who unfortunately was killed by Russians, he hadn't been living in Ukraine for about 15 years. He had a great middle-class lifestyle in Finland, in Helsinki, but he came back. And for me, these are like the people who I would call the Ukraine, which really meaning the Ukraine, which is really Ukraine, like the real country. Not those who talk about, like, flags and wave their flags and stuff like that. Not those who talk about patriotism and, I don't know, the language issues or the purity of the language. which in translation can be, yeah, the purity or like talking about the country without the definite article. These are the people who sometimes talk the sujik, which is the mixture of Ukrainian and Russian. These are the people who sometimes write with mistakes. These are the people that are sometimes, well, not very politically correct. They make some, I don't know, homophobic jokes, for example. But still, these are the real people, like not the ones that we, not polished. Yeah. And mostly these people who are not polished, who defend the people who are talking about the narratives or about how we should present it in literature, mostly it's like that. But not necessarily, of course, because I think that the Ukrainian army, or generally the forces of defense, they are very representative of what Ukraine is in all respects. Like, for example, parts of the soldiers still speak Russian, even now, even though they kill Russians. For example, and now there are some rich people, yeah, who volunteer. So I wouldn't want to say that it's only poor. It's very incorrect. It's about the same percentage, I would say, more or less. There are people from all regions, and this is very important to me, like especially when you're coming to places where, especially closer to the front lines, where different unions, different units of the army cooperate, you can see people from all over, from all walks of life, from all regions, from all professions, and it was very important for me to see this.
I'm so sorry about your friend. Was his name Igor? You mentioned his name in one of the interviews.
Yes, I understand. I became a little bit psychologically like fixated on his death because I didn't think I would have a new friend after the age of 40. And I was 42 when I was 41 at the time we met. He was 46. So this was a very adult friendship, which it is not because like you happen to grow up in the same town and go to the same class, yeah, or to the same university, because there is something similar between you. And of course, it's very painful when this kind of has to end like this. Too soon.
Your comment about how the perception of the country and of the people changed after the initial stage of the Russo-Ukrainian war actually made me change my next question, because I wanted to talk a little bit about your writing style. But what you said made me wonder what you were describing in this stories before, no, well, not before, but right during the initial stage of the war in the Donbas. And it was some very sincere desire, sincere wish to understand why some people would support and welcome the Russian troops, for instance. And there is this protagonist, her name is Lena, if I'm not mistaken, and it was mentioned in the story that she was actually from Galicia, from Galicia, but she was speaking Russian, but then when she was talking to the narrator, she would switch to Sujik as well. And then there was a comment by the narrator saying that, well, I understand why people would support Russia, but I don't understand why they are not criticizing Putin. So, but at the same time, while there are all these different views on how people behave or do not behave, what decisions that they make, also there is a very distinctive sense of generosity, kindness, and love, I would say, toward the residents in the Donbas that the narrator is experiencing. So would you talk a little bit, and I do suppose that it's somehow based on your own experience of going to that area in 2014. So would you talk a little bit about that experience of talking to people, and did you find your answer why some supported, why some didn't, and how all those things just escalated all of a sudden?
When it all started in 2014, it was very different from what it's now. Yeah. At the moment, it's very difficult to explain to foreigners, but there have long been conflicting views on Ukrainian history. And in 2014, the view which is now prevalent, it prevails. But there were still some people who believed in the other narrative, in the narrative of this friendship of the people, and that the Russian Empire was not an empire, but it was like the friendship of the nations. We still used to have a lot of names of cities, streets, and stuff like that, like with this narrative. And of course, many people believe it. It has been shifting. At the time, some people like had been shifting very slowly ever since Ukraine became independent. But I think at the time, many people like couldn't still follow up, and they still followed the old narrative. But that was 2014. And yes, I was trying to be very sympathetic. I'm trying to feel as much empathy as I could to the people I didn't agree with. It's not that difficult, actually. Like, even now, I could say that I am empathetic and I feel for some Russian soldiers. It's very difficult to talk about, but yes, I had to. That's another story. Like, I was at my duties including talking to a lot of Russian soldiers who were prisoners of war, and I could feel like what they feel, but it doesn't mean you have to agree with it. And it was similar with Ukrainians at that time, 2014. But I feel that it changed a lot in 2022. Even those people who used to be like nostalgic for the Soviet Union, for example, or who used to think that, yes, we all together fought against the Nazis in World War II, because this is still a big part of the whole story. Like, as you probably know, the Russians call us Nazis in their propaganda, even though we fought the Nazis together. And so even those people who still believe in the Soviet narrative, they were shocked, because what happened now was, for Ukrainians, very similar, extremely similar, almost identical to what we remember about how Hitler invaded Ukraine in 1941. There is a poem, which I even remember from the Soviet Union, which starts like, the evil dictator attacked at 4 a.m. and stuff like that, and we were told that the war started and Kiev was bombed. And this is exactly what happened for us in 2022. The evil dictator, he also attacked at 4 a.m. I think this is something about, I don't know why, maybe it's tactical, maybe it's like terror, but they both, Hitler and Putin, started at 4 a.m. and they started with bombing Kiev. I was in Kiev at the time when Putin did. And for me, this triggers the historical, like the generation memory of when Hitler also attacked Ukraine, because Russia likes to talk a lot about like the fighting against the Nazism, but just look at the map. The whole of Ukraine, the whole of Belarus were occupied by the Nazis. Only a small portion of Russia was. Most Russia never experienced Nazism. I mean, territorially, I understand that soldiers fought together, but it was Russian soldiers, Ukrainian soldiers. And also, if you look at Wikipedia, there were more percentage of Ukrainians who died in World War II than Russians, much more, many more. There were many more Armenians, and especially Belarusians, by the way, who died. And but Russia, as an empire, that's like an imperialist thing. You say that everything is yours. It's not only Russian Empire. When Britain was an empire, it was the same. When France was an empire, it was the same. This is just imperialism. Russia is this part of the past of the 19th or early 20th century, which still continues, which still has these imperialist values. Mm-hmm. So coming back to your questions, for most Ukrainians, even those who used to live in those narratives of the Soviet Union or still the like friendship of the people, everything changed. And paradoxically, the people who suffer most are the people who Putin claims to support. Because most of the war is happening where the Russian speakers on Ukrainian. Most of the destruction is in those places, in the east of the country, in the south of the country.
So, in terms of what you just mentioned about the number of Ukrainians and Belarusians killed during the Soviet, during the Second World War, unfortunately, in the West, we're still fighting this war in terms of terminology, where the USSR somehow conflated with Russia, and the overall narrative is that more than 20 million Russians were killed, while the number of Ukrainians...
9 million of those 20 million Russians were Ukrainians. But yeah, this is the problem. You also look at any Hollywood movie, and when they mean Soviet, they say Russians.
Yes.
So there's this conflation. The Soviet Union was comprised of 15 different republics, and more than 15, I think, like dozens of different nationalities or ethnicities, whatever you call it.
But this misrepresentation, unfortunately, still perseveres, particularly in the, so to speak, like the broader public domain. I really wanted to get to that question about your writing style. Who are your teachers? And I ask that because, on the one hand, the whole collection reminded me to some extent of American literature, particularly the sense of traveling, quest, and journey, and these are essential for American literature. On the other hand, I'm thinking about this story, Bazaar Never Sleeps, and somehow it made me think of Gogol. And it's such a wonderful locus that gives a very insightful, I would say, representation of what the entire country is. So who are your teachers?
I didn't think about it, but actually, yes, this is a typical story by Gogol. If we're talking about Gogol, for example, this is the case, I just wanted to mention this briefly, a case of imperialist-like reappropriation. Gogol used to be a Ukrainian writer who, for obviously careerism, started to move from Ukraine to the center of the empire, which was St. Petersburg, and started to write about the general empire, well, the face of the empire in general. So his most known works, the later works, are about it's like in Russia. They're not happening in Ukraine anymore. But his early work was happening in Ukraine, mm-hmm. of course.
Mm-hmm.
So as for my teachers, but you're correct, actually. I was very much influenced by the American literature, mostly. I mean, English-speaking literature in general, like I mentioned D.H. Lawrence, for example. But for some reason, yeah, I tended to read American literature more. I think that's because I used to live in the U.S. when I was a very young person, well, like 23, 24, 25, at several times. I lived in the U.S. and in Latin America, but I never mastered the Spanish language. But I started reading in English. And as for Americans, I am now reading and rereading Faulkner, for example. This may be not very obvious from the types of the stories I write in the Ukraine book, but I also have some other stuff. So Faulkner, and early on it was Hemingway. I love the way she writes. Among the contemporaries, I admire Jonathan Franzen, especially his The Corrections book, is the one I reread maybe four times. And as we were talking about about traveling writing, I was very much influenced by Henry Miller, and I was very much influenced by Jack Kerouac. Jack Kerouac, especially not even on the road book, but The Dharma Buns, is also the book I read and reread. I have it, like I ordered the original versions here to Ukraine and love to reread it. So yes, American literature, but I was also influenced by Ukrainian literature and by Russian literature. This is very simple because I read both languages, and like it still isn't like that because like the Russians attacked us, I I don't read Russian anymore. For example, there is a contemporary Russian writer, Vladimir Sorokin, who is very great about capturing his own nation. And usually he writes dystopias. So he's a great writer who captures his own nation, who understands his own nation. And for that reason, by the way, has to live abroad.
So you graduated from Kyiv Mohyla Academy, and I can by ask if Tamara Denisova was your professor there? She taught American literature or?
No, because I didn't graduate from the literature faculty, the language or linguistic faculty. I graduated as a philosopher.
I see.
So, yeah, I'm still very interested in philosophy, but I graduated from philosophy as a philosopher, and then I started writing. So you don't necessarily you don't necessarily graduate as a in literature studies or in literature or even in language in order to study.
Yeah, of course. It's one of those stereotypes about which you don't think and then you ask questions like that. But there is one story which is which is about Cherkasy region, which I'm from. There is a very, on the one hand, funny situation, on the other hand, quite ironic situation, where the conversation is about this overlap of the present and the past. And the story says that the Cherkasy region is the region of Shevchenko and all this great history of Ukraine. But on the other hand, the dwellers, the citizens there are very, what we would probably describe today as traditional. And they are not open to the present, I would say, like developments or present ideas. And those women about whom you write espouse very old-fashioned, I would say, old-fashioned views on what a marriage is or what a relationship between men and women are. So I'm saying this in order to ask you about this presence of the past in the present and how it will play out in Ukraine in the future as we move toward our victory and as we will have to cope with a lot of trauma, and we are coping with this trauma right now as well. But it will take decades, of course, to somehow come to come to terms with the loss, and the past will be part of it. So, would you share your views on this the presence of the past in the present and its role for the future?
I was thinking a lot about it. In fact, I already wrote a short book of nonfiction, which had been translated into French, but hasn't been yet translated into English. It is also prepared for print by Seven Stories. And it's partly about this past, present, and future. I was thinking about how funny, well, this is tragic, but it's also funny how we have a lot of different things in the past, like any nation, any people. And what is happening now is obviously how we reshaped our past, or I would rather say how we reshape how we see our past. When I was a kid in the 90s, in school, in high school, in all the literature lessons in schools, in all the history lessons in school, we were taught basically how we Ukrainians are the sufferer nation. Something like the Jews, in fact. I think this is very similar, but well, yeah, we were not exterminated on such an extent and with such a purpose, but probably your readers or our listeners will also know that Ukrainian Holodomor caused by, I would say, the Soviet Empire, not necessarily the Russians, was also a genocide, and it has been recognized as genocide. Several million people died. It was more of a neglection than on purpose, but anyways. So we were taught in school before how we are the sufferer nation. Now my kids are in middle school, and I can see how they are taught how we are the fighter nation. Mm-hmm. So this shows how you reshape your past based on your own presence. Even I would say based on contemporary propaganda. This is not a good word, but applied to ourselves, but this is what it is. For example, like in Ukrainian history, at one time there is this the artificial famine which killed many people. At the other side, now we are taught more and more about that there was a lot of resistance that famine, including armed resistance. Also, any other thing like this, you can see that 100 years ago, Ukraine has already lost a war for independence from the Russian Empire. Unfortunately, we lost it, but there was a war from 1917 or 1918 till about 1922. It's a complicated story. But now we are learning about the fact that we actually fought all this time. And at that time, we were not helped by anybody. We were not helped by the U.S. with arms. We were not helped by anybody at all. And still, we fought against a prevailing force for 4 or 5 years. So it's the same. It's like you can see, you can look at the same story from different perspectives. Like, yes, you lost, but you were a fighter. Mm-hmm. And even like, this is very sentimental perhaps, but I was very much bored by the Ukrainian anthem, because when it's repeated and repeated and repeated, it's like the American, you know, Pledge of Allegiance. I don't know how it works. It wouldn't work in Ukraine, because this causes you to like start to dislike it, because you are forced it. It's being forced on you as a child. So yeah, I dislike the Ukrainian anthem. But then as the war started, and we started to sing the anthem in the army sometimes, like for the rally. And you actually now understand what it means. Like, for example, also about the past, the anthem mentions our Cossack heritage. Like, I think of the third line or the fourth line. And at the time I heard it, like, and I thought about it, this is actually maybe what makes us so much different from the Russians, because we have this anarchist past, and it seems like it was so far away, but it's not, because this Cossacks, all this history was then one of the main topics for our national writer Taras Shevchenko. And since he became the national writer, it's now in the memories of everybody how we used to be free, we used to be this like anarchists, we used to be free from Russia, basically. That's what Taras Shevchenko is writing all the time. So, of course, the past influences us a lot. And I was thinking also about the recent past. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm actually a bit sorry about the Russians, like the Russian liberals, because all they have in the last 20 years is the history of losing any fight. Losing all the time, like oppression, everybody gets to prison, gets killed. In Ukraine, it's the contrary. In 2004, we had already a fight against our own authoritarianism, and we won. Then in 2010, the same guy that we were fighting against came back, like similar to how Trump tries to come back, and he became the president, even though we were fighting against him. But we started a new series of protests, and we expelled the guys from the country. And so we have like the society, I don't know how you call it, or the part of the society, the active part of the society, we won again. So we have this history of winning in protests. And including my personal history, like small protests, I still am a very left-wing person, and we had very small protests against very local issues, which here in the center of Kyiv, and we won. And so when you see that you can win in the situations where you think it would be impossible, this is probably one of the reasons why in 2022 the Ukrainians, well, the active minority, yeah, decided that even though the Russian armed forces are obviously much stronger, we still can win, because we have this history of winning against all odds.
Well, I would like to continue this conversation with the translation process itself. So you also a translator, and the one of the challenging parts for this collection is that the texts are written in Russian, in Ukrainian, and also some fragments appear in Surzhyk. And did you collaborate with your translator in terms of how those parts are translated, or you just do not interfere into that translation process, and you let Zhenya Tomkins made all those decisions? Because I in fact gave the original text to one of my students for reading. And she is learning Ukrainian, but it was very hard for her to differentiate between the Surzhyk, for instance, or the proper Ukrainian or the Russian language. And at the same time, I was reading the English version, and sometimes we wouldn't understand each other because she was exposed to much more variety, I would say, linguistic variety.
Remember I said about being influenced by Faulkner? So this is the thing. Faulkner, in his best works, he writes the way people pronounce. Sometimes it's very difficult to read him in English, even though I speak English rather fluently, or at least I read it fluently. I think it's also difficult for some English speakers, because Faulkner is writing the way people say. The way people say, like the uneducated people in the South, for example, like a body does travel. For example, this is lecture of the Latin August. This is part of my influence, and this is why I also tried to write, not in all books, but in this including, try to, I don't know how you say I write in Russian. I think the narration is always in Ukrainian, but the way people talk is usually very close to the way they actually talk or would talk.
That's what I meant. No, the narrator speaks in
Ukrainian. The narration is in Ukrainian, but the direct speech is usually in all varieties of how people talk. And it was also important for me to show, without telling, just to show that people speak differently in different parts of the country. At the time, of course, I didn't think about how hard it would be to translate, because that was not my main issue at the time. How it would be translated. As for Zhenya, I may be prejudiced, but I think she's just the best translator from Ukrainian into English. This is very much because she is of Ukrainian descent, but she grew up in England. In the home environment in the United States. So she just understands it. She gets it. Sometimes she asked me several some points which she didn't understand. Mostly it was about very contemporary things, not so much about the Surzhyk, which is a mixture of Ukrainian and Russian. Mostly it was about contemporary slang, which she wouldn't be able to know because she hasn't been living in Ukraine for at the period, for example. And by the way, sometimes I also removed some slang, which I wrote in 2010, but which already became obsolete in 2018, because this is what happens to live languages. They change all the time. Zhenya Tomkins is a great translator. I'm very happy that she's doing the translations.
And in terms of your intention, right, to show languages or maybe dialects people speak in Ukraine, there is this one of the Donbas stories where in which there is so much vulgar language, that was an interesting story, wondering how it could be somehow delivered. And
Because the guy, this is actually a non-fiction story. It was basically, I didn't use a voice recorder at the time, but I was always like trying to be a human voice recorder, like always repeating what people say. And the guy was actually speaking like the vulgar language as a separate language. And it was fun to just represent it. It's good that there are no real taboos in literature now. Because at the time when Chekhov or even Faulkner would be writing, this would be impossible. I remember that some of the Faulkner's books were actually banned in the United States for vulgarity. The Sanctuary, for example. Yeah. So now it's simpler. I would even say that it's simpler in Ukraine than in the United States. In the United States, there's this coming back of censorship, but on different grounds now. Because I'm following the Pan America and the newsletter, and there's a lot of shadow banning of books in the United States. In Ukraine, it's not like that. In Ukraine, luckily for us, it's freer, which is funny. I didn't think about it until I said it. Sometimes I feel that it is at the moment.
Yeah, and particularly after 2022, there is some sort of boom in terms of reading and publishing, and that's probably one of the manifestations of this war response, which probably was surprising to many.
This is paradoxical, yeah, but people started reading, writing, and became more interested in literature or in Ukrainian literature, in Ukrainian languages, in Ukrainian language. But yeah, the price is very high.
Yeah.
It's like the same. I'm thinking all the time that it's only because of this war that I am being translated into all these languages. But the price is still high. And the sad thing is that the people who pay most of the price, they are not translated into English or French or German for that. This is what causes, I don't know, I have some guilt because of that. I mean, one of the reasons I decided to join the army was basically to live up to my left-wing ideals. Because if you are so interested in the human rights, and especially the rights of the poor, you have to be with them. But still, it doesn't work like that because I have, not to say, but I have some profit. Yeah. But my books, which were even old books, now are translated. But those guys who I wanted to be with, they don't have anything to. I mean, yeah, they have different things. I'm wrong here because they have different things like their dignity. Many of the people I talk about is like they got out of sometimes like their routines and now they feel more dignity. That's one of the things that is very, it's also something that I didn't think before, like one of the things which are very important for Ukrainians, and this is part of the tradition, is probably this like dignity, honor, and the story of how our ancestors used to be like these Cossacks. For those who don't know, like for listeners, Cossacks are those people who didn't want to be enslaved or was serfdom in the medieval ages. And so they ran away and published their own republic. And that's how Ukraine came into being. Partly. Yeah, that's a simplification. Timothy Snyder would say this is like outrageous simplification. But for us, like, this is our mythology.
Yeah, and definitely the price is very high, but I don't think that you should feel guilty. I think that there are a lot of agents, right, that should feel guilty for ignoring Ukraine, for instance, for constantly rediscovering Ukraine, starting with 1991 and starting the history of Ukraine with 1991, forgetting all the centuries that actually led to that independence proclamation in 1991. Then we discovered Ukraine after the Orange Revolution. Then we again rediscovered Ukraine after the Dignity Revolution. Then again, we're rediscovering Ukraine in 2022. So I think that some other
people should like, what?
But yeah, that's something that Oksana Zapushko also pointed out in one of her statements, that we keep just rediscovering Ukraine.
Yeah, and every time it's like, where does it come from? And then you remember that there was also Nestor Makhno, who was like fighting both against the Russians, like the communists, and the Russians who were the far, the imperialists. Yeah. And most people just don't remember it. It becomes very... But it's not only about Ukraine. I remember Milan Kundera wrote the same thing about Czechoslovakia. Like, he had to remind every time that Czechoslovakia is still occupied. Hopefully this doesn't happen to Ukraine, partly because of all these people who decided to fight.
Yeah, of course. Well, hopefully we will have some better days soon. But thank you so much, Artem, for this conversation. And I'm very happy that this collection is available in English, because it can be a very valuable addition to any course on literature or culture or history, in terms of understanding how the war started and what Ukrainians are fighting for. And also, as I mentioned, I suggested this book for one of my students who are learning the Ukrainian language. And it can be a wonderful resource to not only learn the language, but also learn some cultural nuances and some specificities. So thank you so much for the book. And again, congratulations on this translated version. And please don't feel guilty for that. I hope that this book will find a lot of readers. Thank you again, Artem.
Thank you, Natalia. It was a pleasure.
Today, I spoke with Artem Chapai, author of The Ukraine, translated from Ukrainian by Zhenya Tomkins and published by Seven Stories Press in 2024. Thank you for listening to New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.